Blog Talk Radio.
All right, thanks for listening. This is The Unknown Show. I'm your host, Bud Smith. Tonight we're going to talk to Aurora Kill Poet about her book, Sugar Tank. And we're also going to talk to Len Koontz, author of Dark Sunshine. That's that. All right, Dan, thanks for listening. Got two great writers on tonight. First up, we're going to talk to Aurora Kill Poet. And she is one of the peeps at the helm of Kill Poet Press. Jason Neese and Aurora Kill Poet teamed up doing that great website. If you haven't checked out Kill Poet recently, give them a peek. They always got some great shit. But today on the show, I want to talk to Aurora about her recent collection of poetry out from Cliffjaw Press, and it's called Sugar Tank. Aurora, how you doing?
I'm good, kid. How are you?
Good. What are you up to these days?
Moving and getting married.
Wow. Those are two things that I like to hear, moving and shaking, you know. Where are you moving to?
I am moving to Indianapolis. Never thought I would leave California, but I am straight up leaving California and going to Indianapolis.
Yeah. When you move to Indianapolis, they automatically give you, like tickets to the Indy 500, like, on your first day in the city. The mayor comes to your door.
I wasn't told that was part of the deal. That I know that, though, I believe I've made the right decision.
Yeah. The mayor comes to your door, and he knocks, and you invite him in, and you have a some kind of typical traditional Norwegian Norwegian food is big in Indianapolis, right? I'm assuming, I'm guessing, I hope.
I think so. Actually, yeah, the names of all their stores are a little Norwegian now that I think about it.
Cool. I got that one right on blind luck. And the mayor comes in and gives you the key to the city and free tickets to the Indy 500, and you're off.
Well, I want that mayor to be like the ghost of Kurt Vonnegut wearing a Pacers t-shirt.
Oh, yeah.
So just roll up all the good Indianapolis things into one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Kirvana gets a big Indianapolis guy, Indiana guy. What's the deal with Gene Hackman? Is he like a big deal there from Hoosiers? Like, does everybody kind of look like Gene Hackman walking
down
the street?
That is hilarious. No, I don't think so. I have made that comment before to my fiancé, the guy that I'm going to marry.
Yeah.
And he just kind of looks at me like, that's what everybody that isn't from Indianapolis thinks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you know. It sucks when you're just about to get married and, you know, friends of mine, and I had the same problem myself, you know, it's like, you need a better word for it, you know, fiance. It's such a fucking, it's a horrible thing.
It's just such a douchebag word. It's a douchey word.
Yeah. It's like a Kim Kardashian word, you know.
Exactly. I'm going to be fancy and pseudo-French for a minute.
Yeah.
And then
pseudo-French.
Talk like a teenager the rest of the time.
Yeah. So when are you getting married?
I'm getting married March 1st.
March
That's 1st. Awesome. Where I'm kind of taking your lead. You know, you and Sprout got married in that beautiful theater.
Yeah.
And I was so inspired by our wedding. We're getting married on the Queen Mary in Long Beach, like the old ship.
Oh, that's awesome.
Kind of following that older theme. Yeah, we're getting married in the wheelhouse. Tiny little ceremony, but I'm excited.
That's great.
I'm actually
excited
to get all this done so I can keep living.
Yeah. When I went to L.A. recently, we almost went to the Queen Mary. We were, like, on our way, and then we accidentally pulled the car into the parking lot where there was a bar somewhere else, and we got completely trashed, and the Queen Mary sailed on without us, and that was it.
Well, when I was a kid, it docked right near my hometown. And when I was a kid, that boat didn't look the way it does now. Like, now it's beautiful, and it's restored, and it's all open. When I was a kid, not all of it was. And I remember running around that boat. You know, you hear all these things about it being haunted and all this stuff. If there was ever anyone that was going to see where this boat was haunted, it would have been me, and I never saw anything. But it is kind of cool to be going up, to be going back and saying, okay, well, now I'm a grown-up. I'm not a little kid running around on decks after hours. I'm a big lady.
So you're one of those ghost-seeing badasses? You've seen ghosts before and stuff?
No, I have not seen any ghosts. I honestly think that, you know, it makes it sound really sexy. And so they say it, and then people go, and then they don't see ghosts. And then they just think that it's because they weren't good enough to see ghosts. But I don't think there are ghosts.
Well, about the Queen Mary, But, I mean, you said that if anybody was going to see ghosts, it would be you. Have you seen ghosts anywhere else?
No, I just meant as being a child running around an abandoned boat in the middle of the night. If anyone was going to see one, it would have been a child running around an abandoned boat in the middle of the night.
I bet you that, you know, right behind you, there's a ghost freaking pissed off right now, throwing ghost shit all around the room. But
he's totally not going to keep chopping it up to science and just, you know, it just happened. Coincidence.
Yeah. So recently you had a really cool book come out, Cleftjaw Press. They've been doing some neat stuff. Frankie Metro and Dustin Holland doing some really cool underground writing mixed with really unique artwork. They've been putting out Cleftjaw, and I think they're taking submissions for issue number 5. But they got this great press going, and they recently put out Sugar Tank. So congratulations on your first full-length book of poetry.
Thank you. And don't downplay your own role in that. But you had some involvement in editing and going through this, and at least helping me proof. So thank you for that.
Oh yeah, I'm just trying not to take the focus away from you. Can you talk to everybody listening a little bit about the book and kind of, set it up a little bit? Somebody's curious, intrigued by the word Sugar Tank. Where does it even come from?
Sugar Tank is, an ex of mine, my ex-girlfriend, that was her term for gay boys, was Sugar Tank.
Uh-huh.
They got sugar in their tank. And I didn't know what it meant. I had never heard it before. And when she explained it to me, I was like, it's like, it made me think of cars, you know, when they tell you, like, not to put sugar in the gas tank, not to, you know, that it'll ruin the car.
Yes.
And actually, it ended up becoming kind of symbolic for me because I think it is kind of supposed to be a detrimental term. It's supposed to not be very positive. And the idea that it's, you know, it's contaminated somehow or it's leavened somehow. But what it made me think of was, you know, the truth is that putting sugar in your tank is not going to do anything to your gas tank.
Yeah, it's not. I was going to say that.
It's really not.
It's not going to do nothing.
It would be the equivalent of putting, like, sand in your tank. Like, it's the same thing. And then when you think about it in those terms of putting sand inside something, it makes me think of oysters, and it makes me think of when a grain of sand is introduced into an oyster, it's not supposed to be there. Or maybe it's not there in all oysters, but eventually that ends up being coated with things. The oyster makes it a part of itself, and it becomes something really beautiful. And in that way, I could relate in feeling that I didn't always fit or that there were things inside myself that didn't fit into the life that I was supposed to have or the people that I was around. I felt like those irritants, those things that made me different, eventually were able to become something that I like about myself. And so that's kind of what Sugar Tank is about. Really, it's a bunch of work that I never thought would ever see the light of day. It was a therapeutic process for me growing up, writing about my life experiences and my family and that transitional period. And I think when you read it, you can kind of see that it goes from a really dark and angry, weird place into maybe something that's still weird, but it's more positive and accepting of itself towards the end. When I wrote all of these things, I never intended for them to be read concurrently, but now that they are, I'm happy about it. It's kind of
that's awesome.
A little book.
Yeah. That's pretty great. I think I got to give you props on a couple things. First of all, you know, when you ask somebody what their book is about, you know, which I guess I wind up doing that a lot. You know, if you can't explain what your book is about in 45 seconds, you know, then you gotta figure out what the fuck the book was about. Man, you nailed it. I'm really happy. You know, I knew you would. You tell me what the thing's about, and you know, that's like what Einstein says. You know, you should be able to explain your work to a 6-year old. I'm a 6-year old, so I know. I'm happy to hear that. But the other thing too is, it's a hell of a thing to say. You thought the stuff would never see the light of day, and I'm glad it did. I'm glad the book is out there. I enjoy it a lot.
Thanks. It's kind of an unnerving process, this getting published thing. I have a whole lot more respect now for the people that do it, because I think in our lives we construct the situations and the friendships, the relationships in our lives, so that we don't have to experience a lot of judgment and rejection. At least I know I do, right?
Yeah.
And when your work is in print and then it's for sale, you get to quantify that rejection.
Yeah.
You get to measure approval or rejection based on how many people that don't know you or do know you or who the people are that are buying your books. And it's very enlightening and soul searching and weird.
Yeah.
It opens up a new vomit of emotions for me.
So speaking of emotions, I wanted to know if I could get you to read from the book. I'd really like, you know, I'd love if you were to, let's say, read 3 poems or so, and then we'll talk some more, and hopefully we'll keep coming back to readings, and we'll talk, and we'll give people a little taste of the book and keep the conversation going. So would you do that, please? Give me a few.
Sure. Okay. This one's called "Is It In? Are You Sure?" In approximately years, the single most devastating moments will become indigestion, a hip that tells the weather, the mole that was my pierced nipple, a disease diagnosed and treated, and I find value in the lesson and pity myself less the method of its learning. And this is unacceptable to the part of me that drinks alone, that wears Cake Foundation and plays Robert Merrill on vinyl for the hiss and the cracks in what is unbearably sublime. Perfection, modesty, the island that is virtue, that is cleanliness, the banal and unleavened causes to believe that all is not lost, only hiding from the impatient and the indecisive. Why must a man, a woman, endure past the end of their dignity to earn what is owed, since the moment in time we emerge angry and hemorrhaged, covered in pieces of our mother? It has become easy. It has become lazy. It has become cowardice to believe in God, to endorse a plan, to have faith, to wait on the invisible, the uncertain, what is open to scrutiny, the subjective truth, that everything will be all right, that the universe will unfold as it should, that we are an essential, expendable part of a process constructed in the mind of a being who can hear, empathize with all, yet remain at rest. That such a mind would even need rest when the rest we know comes to us in a box with an incinerator dressed in purple skin and clouded eyes, degrades us and makes us simple and selfish in the eyes of those we tried to love, tried to lead, attempted to protect and satisfy. And in that way, birth is a greater betrayal. Alright, shall I keep going?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that was something. Sorry, sometimes I don't like to jump in, because I'm listening, and I don't want to fuck people up, you know. That was great. Keep going.
All right. Here's one called Diamonds. Okay. Borrowed a Marlboro Ultralight from a lady named Regina, also a lighter, a mint, and her body spray. Walked down to the service entrance, looked down behind a trash can. First drag is a gasoline douche. Second drag is a kneecap. Saturday night, skip across heat waves. I swore to do something helpful if he stopped breathing. I can't remember what it was. But in 2 minutes and 35 seconds, I'll go back to my office smelling like a paintball. my stomach will swallow itself over how appropriate it is she never loved me and how everyone that has cavalierly hopscotches around death while I hold their cell phone in here. The contradiction of the modern geisha box is being man enough to be heard and woman enough to listen, to protect without asphyxia, to comfort, not coddle, to save, whilst always being available for saving. Everyone wants to be a hero sometimes, to fuck and fuck well, and find satisfaction in the presumptuous gratification of fear, modesty, concern, accommodation, amnesty. 5 miles from here, wildfires stuff their mouths with everything that is right, and the sun is the end of my cigarette. All things will bacon in our skulls, under our breasts, from the pinpoint spike of our heel to the hem of the sea. Charcoal is every end. And from space we will resemble a bruise, an injury of insignificant proportion. We will shrivel to the infinitesimal meaning of a grain of sand under the weight of stars we are yet to touch. We will contract until our skin reflects their image. All things made beautiful in it.
Yeah, that's really something else. I like the way you read. You must have an awesome time with, I know you have a small child in your house. You read them bedtime stories a lot or what?
Not yet. He's kind of too wound up for bedtime stories. At least in my experience. Maybe as I become more accustomed.
Yeah, give that kid some Benadryl and read him some bedtime stories.
I'll read him sugar cane. We'll see what he turns out to be. He has to have something to tell us
about it. Yeah, definitely. Give me another poem, please. Please.
Okay, this one's called Yeah. He told her she was no poet, and he told her he was no man. And he tucked his penis between his legs, and she put her pen back in her purse. And for a moment, they considered the possibility that possessing the tools did not equip them, any more than having a child make you a father, or buying a lotto ticket make you a millionaire. And the world was flat and ordinary and benign and tolerant and unspectacular and eternal. And red was not red, but RGB 20400. And people were not people, but watery ash shaken with the exhale of science. And music was math, and math was vulgar and inspired. And neither of them had ever sustained love or rebirth or injury, only death in several impermanent forms. And the redistribution of particles invented by microscopes to keep them from bench.
And that's three poems from Sugar Tank. And I think everybody ought to read like you. I hope a lot of people listen to this and ton of people yelling, you know. Jesus Christ.
The yelling with like the awkward pausing that happens sometimes. I don't understand
Yeah. Oh my God. I yell, but not when I read. I yell at people. I yell at people about, you know, on the construction
site. Well,
there are
poems that deserve it. But then there are those that are, it's just like, no, I'm listening. I promise I'm listening. Stop doing it.
Yeah. You know, I'm here to listen to your fucking poem. Keep it down, please. I'm trying to enjoy my beer. I get annoyed enough when a band comes on and I'm at a bar and I'm like, Jesus Christ.
God, yeah.
I'm 32 years old. I don't want to hear a rock band. I'm here to drink beer and talk to my wife. Go away, rock and rollers.
No, what drives me crazy is when you're at a read and there are people talking.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I get it. Like, poets, we're social mostly within our, you know, own constraints. And sometimes events are the only times that we get to see each other.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's when we get to see each other. So we're all excited. And if the person that's reading is, like, not somebody you know or, you know, someone that you're like, meh. But then people talk, and that's just so rude. It drives me nuts.
Yeah, it's not bad. You know, it's not bad if people in the audience are having their own sub-poetry reading. Like, you're up there sucking, and they're like, you know what, fuck it. We're just going to kick it off down here in the audience. So I'm starting, you know, I'm starting my own reading in row X or whatever. So are you surrounded by cardboard boxes right now? Is the whole house all packed up or what?
Yeah, I'm camping in my own house for the next month.
Really? When you say camping, you have like a whole like campfire there in the living room, or you still have the heat
on
and stuff?
I'm trying not to turn on the heater, so I have the fireplace on. And I still have, like, a bed, which is good. That'll be here until I move. But I left myself, like, one knife out and a coffee cup.
There you go.
And a pot and a pan. So pretty much my plate and my silverware are now tortilla chips until I go.
That's good. I've been living in the same place now for about 8 years, and I like it here. I really do like it here. I like my neighborhood. I like my apartment. But, you know, I think, you know, if it was easier to move, I definitely would have moved sooner. It's one of those traumatic events. Oh my, you know.
I think so go ahead.
I seem to buy heavy things, you know, because I live in the city, and they'll deliver all this shit to me and basically, like, you know, carry up the stairs. Like, the UPS guy just brought boxes of books I ordered, you know, so he's carrying all this shit. I always feel bad for him. He's carrying all this shit up, and I'm like, man, the more crap I got in here, I got to get it down these fucking stairs. I got to get it into a... I'll probably be in this apartment for the rest of my life. I'm never fucking leaving this apartment.
I thought of you yesterday because I packed up my books finally. I think it was like a thing. Like, I packed up everything else and the books just kept like, no, I'll do those later. And I packed them up yesterday, and the one that's like on top of the last box is Toll Booth. It's your book.
Toll Booth, yeah. Toll Booth.
Yep.
Ah, good times. So, Sugar Tank is floating around. It's landing in all different kinds of regions, places. People on the street are finding it in odd places, bookshelves. You know, they blink and you go open your eyes, all of a sudden there's Sugar Tank, it's on your bookshelf. Are you doing any kind of readings or anything for the book anytime soon or anything like that? You know.
Yeah, I've done a couple of radio shows and we had planned to do some events, but, you know, life happens. And you understand this. I mean, writers that have, like, a life understand this, that, like, life will suddenly happen and all of your plans for this thing that we do so that we don't kill ourselves or each other, you know, this, like, therapy of ours that is writing, sometimes just has to get put on hold a little bit while you do things that involve other human beings. So that's kind of where I am right now. I think that after moving and after the wedding, I can get back to focusing on that.
Oh, sure.
But for now, it's you know, I'm counting on people that we know and the people that read things incidentally and the books that get left in interesting places.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of readings, can I get you to read some more poems from the book?
Sure. I actually wanted to read one that's not in the book. But
read whatever you want. Read whatever you want.
So the way that I, you know, became introduced to you and to the boys over at Questjob, Frankie, was that somehow, do you remember, we got into this really weird writing circle, and we were writing some ridiculous nonsense for a while?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was, what was it? Frankie Metro he sent me a message, and he said that he really liked your writing. And he wanted to try to do something collaborative with you and me somehow. And, and we started this. It was going to be the most – it was ridiculous. It was really cool.
It was super fun to do, and it was weird, and I don't think we'd ever have an audience for it outside of ourselves, except for today, because I'm going to read one of these things. But the first one that we had talked about was we got obsessed with the idea of a parasitic twin. And all of us, we were trying to write this continuous story. Like, you know, you picked it up, or Frankie picked it up first, and then I took it, and then you took it. But we're also different in our writing styles, that it was really hard to keep it cohesive, other than the idea that somebody had a parasitic twin. So I was going to read my little excerpt from that collaborative effort, just because otherwise no one else will ever hear these things.
Yeah, right? Yeah, read it.
Yeah. So the setting was an autopsy taking place in one of those big old rooms where they had, you know, the body at the middle of the table, at the middle of the room, and then there was, like, the amphitheater around it watching the doctor perform this autopsy, and there's a guy in the background that is relating more than he should to what's happening. So, okay, parasite twin. industrial Ave Maria bubbles pumped from the vintage Alpines in his chest. Rapture uncomplicated by context, circumcised of its gag reflex, pure as the calcified skin casket being spread to reveal it soft by sharp metal fingers. This developing vascular system, a mound of neon spider webs, old man frail but baby sweet, bulging like a bloated conscience exposed for its gelatin, congealed electricity, a ball of unfinished organs frozen in a sudden death that redefines life. Recognition creeps over the Cyclops, and he pats his right forearm as the camera pierces brown, pink, red, and finally bone to a hand no larger than his pinky nail, returning the high five.
Yeah, I remember that. That was great. some great weird stuff, you know. Can't ever go wrong with the weird.
You kind of just have to roll with the weird, and I felt comfortable in that setting with you guys. I think I told you guys a story about the chicken where we found a chicken that had, like, a huge egg inside its body. Yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah. Frank is great. Great. So, to kind of close out the show here, I would really love if you'd read a couple more poems. Do you have anything you'd like to read?
Absolutely.
Maybe two more?
I will read two more. From Chicken.
Badass.
Okay. All right. So this one, I'm going to read one called The Father and one called The Mother, which are really kind of the crux of this entire book. So, The Father. As a standalone, without scale, I am reasonably sized, an atrocity accessible. Thus, I've chosen to define my character with the events of December 1989. He fell from a frozen catwalk out of the Tree of Life, a bump, ruptured three vertebrae and was laid off. And at this time, he took to hosting imaginary conversations for which I received several slaps with his high school ring turned on the inside daily. I once lost two baby teeth at recess. I nested them under my hot little tongue, refusing to swallow all day just to give them a sense of accomplishment later that afternoon. A spray of typewriter keys as my carriage was returned, so to speak. It was more than once articulated that this was character building, a fact he's taken to forgetting as his hair has begun to leave. I take this rejection of reality as an apology, less for the broken skin, the kneeling on rice, the violence of our Christianity, and more for the events of my conception. My creation began, as most others of my age, in a pair of mint julep tuxedos. His trunk was in need of a sedative like that of a baby elephant, uneducated and eager beyond control. I am the product of my mother's submission, of Spanish daytime soap operas and their platinum chignons looping in his brain on fast forward. I am a child of God. I am an only child, and therefore a perfect illustration for Christ.
Yeah, that's really something else. That's Father, right?
That's Father.
Okay.
All right, and then the mother. You can do it, she says caustically. Ginger as a fanged lamp, leggy like an ocean spider, supple, a strangler, tentacles, loving me airless, liquid me dripping through her belly's hourglass. My tiny hands fixed at noon by a railroad spike to the forehead, I am a sliding clock. Running out. She demands the production of faith, spontaneously erupting life that I cause to become again something else, another balloon animal, the one she knows I can be. I inflate another cheek, another set of lips, a rhetoric horn, a catapult of inflammatory projectiles, living disproof of unnatural love, apocryphal books, and expensive cars. Can I equal a set of bent knees? Would you mind a set of clasped hands? She'll take a set of lowered eyes, possibly dirt and air, if it's not too much trouble, fear and love, iron and clay, a pair of spectacles, a tamed mind, and one last thing, a missile from Christ. Poor Mary and Virgin Mary, perfectly submissive in my free will, the impossibility fused by he for whom all things are possible, and in gratitude my panties fill with tears.
I tell you what, you really are right. Those are definitely the pivot points of the whole book right there. Those two poems right there. So I want to thank you for coming on. I think I think we got to do this again real soon. I don't know.
We should. Thank you for having
Yeah, it was a huge pleasure to have you on the show. And I hope you move. I hope you have a really easy move. I hope you have a great. I'll talk to you before your wedding day. I wish you the best of luck. You know, March 1st. Greg, congratulations on all your great stuff you got going on.
Thanks, bud.
All right, talk to you soon.
All right, talk to you later.
Okay, and that was Aurora Kill Poet, author of Sugar Tank. Can't go wrong with Sugar Tank out from Cleft Jaw Press. It's a full-length collection of poetry. It's got some great artwork on the front. It's got a robot. Robots are awesome. Check that out. Next on the show, we're going to talk to Len Kuntz, and he's the author of a whole ton of great flash fiction. He's the kind of guy, he's just got flash fiction everywhere. I think the count is up to, 700 published pieces of flash fiction floating around on the internet and in print. And if you'll be patient with me right here, I got a bio, which is something I fail at getting bios. Len Kuntz is a writer from Washington State and editor at the online literary magazine MetaZen. I love me some MetaZen. His work appears widely in print. He's been in all kinds of great places, PAG, Necessary Fiction, and his new collection coming out, Dark Sunshine, which is coming out from Meg Tewitt's Connotation Press, and that will come out February 28th at AWP, it looks like. And in January of 2015, his second collection, I'm Not Supposed to Be Here and Neither Are You, will come out from Aquaeus Books. You can find him at lenkuntz.blogspot.com. And you can find him right here, too. He's on the show now. Len, how you doing? Oh, I don't think I clicked the button. Hold on. Hey, Len, you there? Len Kuntz, are you there? Hey, Len, you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, sometimes I'm a failure at the switchboard sometimes, you know. I just click around random things. So how's it going, man? What, you calling from New Jersey tonight?
I'm calling from Seattle, a little north of Seattle by an hour.
Oh. Well, I got to say, Seattle is pretty good, too. I'm a fan of Seattle, and I'll be headed there, as will a lot of people. For this AWP thing that's creeping up, the writers gathering, whatever the hell it's called, for real. So what you doing in Seattle?
10,000 writers. No, I live in Seattle. I think you got confused. I used to live in New Jersey, but I live in Seattle.
Wait a second.
I have.
You moved away from New Jersey?
I know.
I can't
believe
it.
I actually love New Jersey. I'm a huge fan of New Jersey. I always wanted to be governor of New Jersey. They call it the Garden State.
Yeah, well, it is, you know, if you get away from, you know, I think another day I was just in northwest New Jersey, and it's very, very green, and there's rocks everywhere, and people are surprised by that. And then if you go down to, the beaches are great on the coast, and then if you go to the far west, all of a sudden there's farms and shit, and the South Jersey farms and more great beaches, and it's very, like you said, the Garden State, man.
Yeah, it's called the Garden State. The hard thing is when you fly in there. You know, the Newark, you fly over the refineries and, like, the worst parts of the town right there. That's what most people see. But anyway,
the worst parts. That's why I work. I work at the new oil refinery that you fly over and say, holy shit, who would work there? I'm waving at all the planes. I'm waving at all the aeroplanes, man. So, man, it's great to have you on the show today, and you know, I want to talk about some things you got coming up. First off, you have this book coming out. I guess did you work directly with Meg Tewitt as an editor with that, or Connotation Press putting out Dark Sunshine?
Yeah, she was the editor, and then Ken Robidoux is the publisher. And Boston at AWP Connotation had done a reading And I read there along with some other great writers, and I had some pieces in there. And so Ken and I started talking about, you know, putting out this collection. And, you know, everyone was a little tipsy, so I wasn't sure if he was serious or not. And, you know how it goes at AWP. And then we talked and was getting going, and then it kind of languished until about 3 weeks ago. And then all of a sudden, in 3 weeks, the book's being printed. So it's
That's
pretty
great.
Exciting for me. Yeah, it's really exciting.
Yeah, having a book, you know, it's like when you're a little kid, it's like Christmas Eve, you know, you can see it coming. And that feeling definitely goes away when you get to be older about Christmas. You know, you're kind of like, you know, I can get whatever the fuck I want, so what do I care about what I get out of my Christmas tree? But I get that same kind of feeling from putting a book out, you know, working, you know, you got this gift coming, don't you, Lynn? Not that you got a gift, but it just feels like that, you know. But you can't wait to unwrap your fucking present, huh?
Yeah, I'm pretty excited to see it because, yeah, I've actually wanted to be a writer since I was 9.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, you have a book, you feel a little validated. It means something, you know, it's nice.
Well, when I was 9, I wanted to be an old man with a cane. I wanted to have gray hair and you know, walk with a limp or something. So I'm moving towards that. That's working out for me.
Well, you're gonna get that wish.
We're both getting our wishes, man. This is perfect. So,
great world.
So the name of the book is Dark Sunshine. And you kind of, like, talk about it a little bit, set it up for anybody who's listening. Is there a, I don't know.
Yeah,
you know,
we've got about 130 pages in the collection. Mm-hmm. And there are, I think, 54 stories. So they're really short, most of them. There's
sure.
only a couple longer ones. And, you know, I'm always trying to figure out what to say when people ask me what I write. I used to say dark fiction, and then my wife would kind of just jam her elbow on my rib because it doesn't sound very good saying dark fiction. But then I would say I write about dysfunctional relationships, and then one person goes, oh, so you write chick lit, huh? And so, so basically the stories I would say are about damaged or broken people. You know, damage for broken people.
I think what you should say is Seinfeld. I write Seinfeld. It's not true, but people just leave you alone after that, you know. They're like, get it. And then they leave you the fuck alone, you know. Okay, let's talk about something else, you know.
Yeah, the one thing, I just can't figure out how to write a happy story. You know, someone's always something bad's going to happen in one of my stories. So just so people know that, but... For me, the happy endings, like, they're not as interesting, and they feel a little more contrived, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I like it when I like it when you're surprised or when things go awry a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think most of the time a really great story is like, okay, it might be headed towards a happy ending, you're not sure, or it could be heading towards a bad ending, you're not sure, but some fucking editor somewhere has cut off the last two paragraphs of the story, and, you know, you're left hanging, kind of, like, you know, like life. Most of these, you don't know how the story ends most of the time, the real story anyway. But that's cool. That's really cool that you can say that you love unhappy endings, because I love unhappy endings too, especially in movies. I love to see the bad guy win or the good guy suffer a little extra, you know, more of that.
Yeah, it's more interesting, I think, for me anyway, but, you know, everybody's got their cup of tea.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if how we did it with the last caller. They read a little bit. We talked a little bit more about the work, and then we kind of traded off like that. Would you like to read a little bit from the book?
Yeah, actually, I pulled out some pieces that aren't book, but they have the flavor of the book, and there's things that are. I wrote them earlier, and probably like about 3 years ago, and they're somewhat, biographical, I would say. So I got three different ones, but I'll just maybe read them one at a time. They're pretty short. This first one is called Boy Wonder, and it was in Left Hand Waving. Isn't it funny? Come on, my brother said, punching me in the arm. You got to admit, this is funny. I knew his trick. Kyle wasn't subtle about changing the subject. Not that anyone could be under the circumstances. Red Skelton was on the silent television, showing a cow to his friend when the animal hiked up its tail and did its business right there on the stage. Try to laugh a little, Kyle said. You don't always have to be so glum. It's not real. If so, you can't fake cow poop. The 1969 Inland Empire War of the Worlds took place this weekend, and Mother's friend, the pro wrestler, was staying with us until then. His stage name was Boy Wonder. He had a chest as broad as a wheelbarrow, biceps as big as frozen hams, and hair dyed a queer yellow shade. As part of his act, he wore a man diaper on stage. Dad was in Pendleton fixing someone's broke-down Peterbilt and wasn't going to be back for a few days. Even though the bedroom was at the far end of the trailer, we could hear them going at it. I wondered if he was as rough with sex as he was in the ring. Because I'd broken the television sound button, Kyle went over and turned on the radio. The new Three Dog Night song came on, the tune about one being the loneliest number, but two being as sad as one. I hate that stupid song, I said. It doesn't make any sense. Who says it has to? Kyle said. We went to the Old Country Buffet for dinner. I had fried imitation calamari and imitation crab. I ate four platefuls. I wanted to make myself sick. Boy Wonder kept staring at me, his eyes bluer than sky. Mom ate one-handed, the other hand beneath the table, as if I was blind as well as dumb. That night, Boy Wonder showed us some moves, a fireman's carry and a three-quarter Nelson, stuff we already knew. He explained about everything being fake, even the blood was just exploding ketchup packets. He shared how strategy was exchanged during headlocks and how one wrestler always slammed a boot on the mat at the same time he foe-struck his opponent, thereby creating diversionary sound effects. Winners and losers, it was all predetermined. Then why do it, I asked. That's just dumb. Mother slapped me on the hand. Don't get smart. Back at the trailer, we watched Apollo 10 land on the moon for the 100th time since it had happened the week prior. When did Dad get home, I asked. Mother pursed her lips and breathed hot through her flared nostrils. She was sitting on the edge of the love seat, a knee-touching Boy Wonder. Do you have to ruin everything? Well, who's to say this moon business is real anyway, I said. If I was going to spoil things, I wanted to spoil them good. I mean, those astronauts could be bouncing around on any desert. Kyle stood up before Mom or Boy could. He punched me in the gut harder than I've ever been hit. I heard Mother gasp and saw her smile. Wonder grinned, too. That night, Kyle and I lay in our bunks, watching the wood paneling shudder as if our trailer had the chills. We couldn't hear them, but we could feel the effects of their actions. One more night, Wonder would be gone. I hit you because I didn't want him or her hitting you, Kyle said. I know. Below me, Kyle was tossing something in the air and catching it. You think we're going to live through this? He asked. I stared at a water spot on the ceiling. In the center of the faded ring, a spider was knitting. I haven't figured that out yet, I said. Well, Kyle said, if we do, you should write about it, you know, when we're older. No one would believe any of this. My brother was silent for a moment longer, throwing a ball into the air, catching, throwing, catching. After a while, he stopped and said, you know, I think that's why they call it fiction.
That's something else. There's a lot of cool things there. I got to talk a little bit about that Three Dog Night song, the one.
Yeah, yeah.
That their version of the song kind of sucks, but I'm a fan of Harry Nilsson. The record that song is from is great. Are you familiar with Nilsson Smilsson? You ever hear that album? 1971.
Yes.
That is a fucking awesome record.
Yeah,
that is.
I
just listened to that earlier today, as a matter of fact. And I had a friend who worked at the Old Country Buffet. What a shitty establishment that was. And he was like a fry cook there, or line cook, whatever you call it. And man, he cried when he lost that job. We all couldn't believe it. We were like, Jesus Christ, you should just, it's like you just got released from prison, you know? Fucking Old Country Buffet, jeez. They're not even around anymore, I don't think, are they?
Did they? We've got one out here.
What were you saying?
We have one out here.
Old you got one out there?
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry for you. I'm sorry for you. I'm saying a prayer for you right now.
Lots of fried food there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, can't be all that bad. So, would you like to, what was that one called again?
That was called Boy Wonder.
Yeah. Would you please read another one?
I will. This one is like one of the very first stories I wrote, and it was published in Story Glossia. And this one's probably about 98%. True. It's called Summer Scalping Scarecrows. Mother teaches us how to steal. We start with Henderson's cornfield under cover of the night, our station wagon skulking down the aisles like a muttering alligator. She throws us out, tosses us the gunnies, and we scamper through the rows, and I start ripping off ears as fast as I can. It feels like cheap murder, or beating up a kid, someone helpless and smaller than me. When I pull them from the stalk, they make a scratching noise, similar to mother's fingernails on the armrest, or the sketchy rumble of her cigarette cough. The corn leaves are rigid and sweaty, and the corn hair tickles my neck, but just for a moment until Davy jams his elbow into my rib. "Stop fucking around," my brother says. His eyes are electric brown, Mexican jumping beans. Black smears of grease sit below them. Davy takes this shit seriously. He looks like a resentful quarterback or a warrior looking for a scalp. When I still don't get it, he's flicking me in the gut. But we work in the middle where we can't be seen. He hisses, flops down, slides in the dirt on his belly, an iguana now. A combat soldier. He motions that I should follow, and I do, because I'm scared and confused and dizzy. Old man Henderson is who we work for during the day, and here we are robbing him at night. I know these fields as well as I know the 12x12 bedroom I share with Davy. We shouldn't be here. We're poor, but we're not starving. In the center of the field, the stalks sway with the breeze, their tips dipping, brushing shoulders as we work, whispering conspiratorially. I can't stop shivering, even though it's a hot, humid summer night. Davy has a flashlight. One end is stuffed in his mouth. Light comes out the other end in swaths and cones. Davy's face glows menacing lavender. He sees me staring and thwacks me across the forehead with the flashlight. He calls me a stupid fag as I finger the new bruise and rub his saliva from my eye. I help Mr. Henderson put up the new set of scarecrows that stand at the sides of the field, arms outstretched as if crucified. It was a lazy job given to me, I presumed, as a kindly favor. Usually I was charged with moving the 20-foot-long irrigation pipes and shoring up rows or pruning, which is the same as prison work when the temperatures get past 100. Anyway, Mrs. Henderson gave him a half dozen Albertson grocery bags stuffed with all sorts of clothing, and Mr. Henderson told me, go to it. As it was run for bringing up the news to Mother, I'd once confessed to Mr. Henderson that I wanted to be a fashion designer when I grew up. His eyes worked over my statement, and out of his shirt pocket he pulled a piece of straw the size of a pencil. He chewed it for a while. It took him so long to answer that I thought my shame might burn me to death, but then he showed me a grin. It was wide and toothy and real. That's just wonderful, son. I thought about that label, son, No one has ever called me that. Then he added, it's important to have large-sized dreams. So I figured there was a tie to me confiding Mr. Henderson that day and him wanting me to put together a collection of scarecrows. I did as I was told. I would have, no matter the request, since I was getting paid cash money, and, as anybody can tell you, that's a hard thing to come by for a family like ours. When I was finished, I had six fairly realistic men. They were skinny things because the straw kept slipping down their drawers or out of their sleeves. But they looked fine, stylish even. Afterward, there were a few garments left over, one being a sky blue turtleneck that didn't make sense on a scarecrow. Mr. Henderson said, you like it? And I lied and said no, because even though the color was blue, it was too light, pastel, bordering on effeminate, and I didn't want him or anyone else getting ideas. Ah, take it, he said, go on. And I did. After I got home, I stuck it between the box springs and the mattress I shared with Davy. One of these days, I plan on showing him, but that might not be for a while. When our gunny sacks are full of corn, we stagger in the dark toward the lurking station wagon. Mom sits smoking with the dome light on. She doesn't blink, doesn't say a word, just starts the engine and pulls the silver stick shift on the side of the steering wheel, and we drive off. The next morning, Mr. Henderson calls me to his office, which is really just a trailer sunk into the sun-baked mud northeast of where some broke-down combines slumber. His golden lab, Leroy, scents me at the door, sneezes, and scampers off. Henderson shouts to come in after I knock. I hesitate and try to measure the tone of his voice, sifting through it like a gold miner for evidence of a mood. The door catches and won't open. Kick it at the bottom, he tells me. I wonder why he doesn't just open the thing himself. You gotta kick it, he says. I still can't tell if there's anything to learn from his tone, but by now I'm running, and his voice isn't very loud anymore. Stocks slap me because I'm off balance. My feet burn. My eyes sting. It's not even noon yet, and I'm soaked with sweat. I run through the corn row, and I don't stop.
Well, that's really something else, man. I love your flash fiction. If you want to call it that, some people call it that. It's just one of these words that just floats around. Who knows what flash fiction really is? Word length and all that. Do you have any? I know you got to have readings coming up. Are you gonna be at AWP?
Yeah, I'm actually doing. I'm probably doing more readings than I want to do. I'm doing four of them there. The problem when you do a reading is then you don't get to go hear somebody else read, because they all happen simultaneously. But, yeah, I am doing it. How about you?
I don't know. I think I'm doing one. My goal is just to go and see everybody else and meet people for the first time, There's a lot of people I don't know in person, and that's why I'm going, I can read whenever.
Yeah, that's so much fun when you meet all these people virtually, like on the internet and whatnot.
Yeah.
And you know them from their Facebook page or whatever, but a lot of people are better on their Facebook page. But it's going to be a great time. I'm really looking forward to it.
You really don't know them for real until you get them drunk and you go through their pocketbook when they go to the bathroom, That's when you really get to know somebody.
Yeah, when I met Roxanne Gay, she's such a force and presence on the internet and in indie presses. But and we shared a cab after she did a reading, and she's actually pretty shy, but she gets on stage and she's like a showman.
It's
really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's like. It's weird when you think of these some of these people are like legitimate like kind of rock stars with writing, which is so bizarre that still is around. Roxanne, I think of Roxanne when I think of that.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just reading a short story at you know, one of something about Bukowski today. I just picked a random book off my bookshelf, and it happened to be a story about, I think the name of the story was "This Is What Killed Dylan Thomas," and it's all about him doing a reading and getting paid $400 in like 1972 or something, and just like being this, you know, he's claiming he's this big literary rock star and all this stuff, and I'm really curious to go and see what the climate is at AWP 2014. How different is it, at, you know, from 1971? I don't know. I have no idea.
Have you never been there?
No.
Have you never
been to AWP? I've never been to AWP. I've never been to any big literary conference thing. I just kind of go and meet people up, pretty much go and meet people for beers and stuff in New York City. Pretty much.
Well, I'll buy you a beer for sure. It's really overwhelming. The first time I went, it was just 10,000 people, and it's just so mammoth. It's really hard to get your arms around. But
yeah.
There's a lot of exciting stuff happening, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, it sounds like a really good time. And I'm looking forward to catching up with you there, you know. We'll have to take up on that beer offer, you know.
Absolutely.
And, all right, man. Well, I want to thank you for giving up some of your evening here to come on the show and read. It's always a pleasure when I can harass people like yourselves to come on the show and read. And I want to thank you for popping on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, bud. I really appreciate it. Have a great night, and I'll see you up here in Seattle.
Okay, man. I'll see you then. Be good.
Talk to you. Bye.
So that's that. I want to thank both guests, Aurora Kill Poet from Book Sugar Tank, out from Cleftaw Press, and Len Koontz, who's got a forthcoming book, which is called Dark Sunshine, out from Connotation Press. Check both those titles out. And if you're an AWP, say hello to both of us, all right? Say hi to myself and Lang. And I think Aurora's going to be there. She's off getting married. Well, props to her. Alright, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next Tuesday. And the guests are going to be James Claffey. He's got a book of short story, Blood of Cold Blue, which is awesome. And Misty Rainwater Lights. Her new book just came out. A novel just came out from Epic Rights Press. And that's called Bullshit Rodeo. And then Tyler Malone is coming on the show too. So tune in for that. Thanks for listening, and have a good evening. Yeah.